that she was too sleepy to move till the afternoon when she went out fishing with George. During the third night, she ate so much that we were quite worried about her. Yet in the morning, in spite of her bulging belly, she trotted into the bush with us and first stalked two jackals and then a flock of guinea fowl. Of course, each time she closed in on them, they flew off, whereupon she sat down and licked her paws. I was walking ahead, but stopped dead at the sight of a rattle. This animal, also known as a honey badger, is rarely seen. It had its back turned towards me, and was so absorbed digging for grubs in the rotten wood of a fallen tree that it was quite unaware of Elsa's approach. She saw it, and crept forward cautiously till she was practically on top of it. Only when their heads nearly bumped together did the rattle take in the situation. Then hissing and scratching, he attacked her with such courage and so savagely that she retreated rather bewildered. Plainly she was too well fed to hunt, except for sport, and there was no fun to be had with such a raging playmate. On our walk home, Elsa, full of high spirits and affection, rolled me over several times in the sand, while I listened to the trumpeting of elephants, which were much too close for my liking. That night, she slept in front of my tent, but just before dawn, her lion started calling and she went off in his direction. Their calls were easy to distinguish. Elsa has a very deep guttural voice, but after her initial roar, only gives two or three woofing grunts, whereas her mate's voice is less deep, and after his roar, he always gives at least 10 or 12 grunts. During Elsa's absence, we broke up camp, and left for Isiolo, hoping that she was in the company of her mate. We were away for about 3 weeks. We returned on the 10th of October. An hour after we got back, we saw her swimming across the river to greet us, but instead of the exuberant welcome she usually gave us, she walked slowly up to me. She did not seem to be hungry, and was exceptionally gentle and quiet. Patting her, I noticed that her skin had become extremely soft and her coat unusually glossy. I saw, too, that 4 of her 5 nipples were very large. She was pregnant. There was no doubt about it. She must have conceived a month ago. It is widely believed that a pregnant lioness, who is handicapped in hunting by her condition, is helped by 1 or 2 other lionesses who act as aunts. They are also supposed to assist in looking after the newborn cubs, for the male is not of much practical use on such occasions, and indeed is often not allowed near the young lions for some weeks. Since poor Elsa has no aunts, it would be our job to replace them. George and I talked over plans to help to feed her and avoid any risk of her injuring herself during her pregnancy. I was to stay in camp as much as I could, and at the nearest game scout post, some 25 miles away, we would establish a herd of goats, from which I could collect a few in my truck at regular intervals. Nuru would remain with me to help with Elsa, and Makadei would guard us with his rifle. Ibrahim could drive, and I would keep one boy, the Toto — the word Toto means a child in Swahili — to act as personal servant. George would visit us as often as his work allowed. As though she had understood our conversation, Elsa hopped onto my camp bed as soon as it was made ready, and looked as if she thought it the only suitable place for someone in her condition. From now on, she took possession of it, and when next morning, as I did not feel well, I had it carried down to the studio, she came to share it with me. This was uncomfortable, so after a time, I tipped it over and rolled her off. This indignity caused her to retire, offended, into the river reeds till the late afternoon when it was time for our walk. When I called her, she stared at me intently, advanced determinedly up to my bed, stepped onto it, squatted, lifted her tail, and did something she had never before done in so unsuitable a place. Then, with a very self-satisfied expression, she jumped down and took the lead on our walk. Apparently, now that she'd had her revenge, everything was again all right between us. I observed that her movements were very slow, and that even the noise of elephants close by only made her cock her ears. That night she rested in George's tent, unresponsive to the call of a lion who seemed to be very near the camp. As in the early morning, the lion was still calling, we took Elsa for a walk in his direction. There, to our surprise, we found the spoor of two lions. When she began to show an interest in these pug marks, we left her and returned home. She did not come back that night, so we were surprised to hear a lion grunting extremely close to the camp. Indeed, in the morning, his pug marks proved that he had been within 10 yards of our tent. The next day, Elsa again stayed away. Hoping to make the lions kindly disposed towards her, George shot a buck and left it as a farewell gift. Then we returned to Isiolo. In the second week of November, we went back to the camp. When we got near Elsa's lie-up, we found the spoor of many sheep and goats and the campsite itself patterned with hoof marks. I trembled to think what might have happened to her should she have killed one of the goats which had been grazing so provokingly in what she regarded as her private domain. Later, our fears were increased by finding the body of a crocodile close to the river. It had been speared quite recently. George sent a patrol of game scouts to deal with the poachers while he and I went out to look for Elsa. For some hours we walked through the bush, calling to her and at intervals shooting into the air, but there was no response. After dark, a lion began to call from the direction of the big rock, but we listened in vain for Elsa's voice. We'd run out of thunder flashes, so when it became dark, all we could do to let her know that we were there was to turn on the penetrating howl of the air raid siren, a relic of Mau Mau days. In the past, it had often brought her into camp. It was answered by a lion. We sounded it again, and again he replied, and this strange conversation went on until it was interrupted by Elsa's arrival. She knocked us all over. As her body was wet, we realized that she must have swum across the river and had come from the opposite direction to that from which the lion was calling. She seemed very fit and was not hungry. She left at dawn, but returned at tea time when we were setting out for our walk. We climbed up the big rock and sat there watching the sun sink like a fireball behind the indigo hills. At first, Elsa blended into the warm reddish colour of the rock, as if she were part of it. Then she was silhouetted against the fading sky, in which a full moon was rising. It was so vast a view, so utterly peaceful and timeless, that I felt as though I were gliding away from reality into a world where man-created values crumble to nothing. Instinctively, I stretched my hand towards Elsa, who sat close to me. She belonged to this world, and only through her were we allowed to glance into a paradise which we had lost. I imagined Elsa in the future playing with her cubs on this rock, cubs whose father was a wild lion, and at this very moment he might be waiting nearby. She rolled on her back and hugged me close to her. Carefully I laid my hand below her ribs to feel whether any life were moving within her, but she pushed it away, making me feel as though I had committed an indiscretion. Soon we had to return to camp, to the safety of our thorn enclosure, and the lamps and rifles with which we armed ourselves against those dark hours in which Elsa's real life began. When we got back, we found that there were a number of Boran poachers in camp who had been rounded up by the game scouts. As a senior game warden, one of George's most important tasks is to put down poaching, for it threatens the survival of wildlife in the reserves. Elsa kept away during that night and the following day. This worried us, as we would rather have had her under our eyes while so many tribesmen and their flocks were around. In the afternoon, we went to look for her. As I came near to the rock, I called out to warn her of our approach but got no reply. It was only when we had climbed onto the saddle, where we had sat on the previous evening, that we suddenly heard an alarming growl, followed by crashes and the sound of wood breaking inside the big cleft below us. We rushed as fast as we could to the top of the nearest rock. Then we heard Elsa's voice very close and saw her lion making away swiftly through the bush. Elsa looked up at us, paused, and silently rushed after her mate. Both disappeared in the direction in which we knew there were some Boran with their stock. We waited until it was nearly dark and then called Elsa. To our surprise, She came trotting out of the bush, returned to camp with us and spent the night there, going off only in the early morning. George went back to Isiolo with the prisoners, but left some game scouts in camp. The evening was lit by lightning, a sure sign that the rains would start soon. Never had I greeted the first downpour with such a sense of relief. For this drenching meant that the Boran would return to their pastures, and temptation and danger would be removed from Elsa's path. When George returned, he brought a zebra for Elsa. This was a special treat. As soon as she heard the vibrations of the car, she appeared, spotted the kill, and tried to pull the carcass out of the Land Rover. Then, finding it too heavy for her, she walked over to where the boys were standing, and jerking her head at the zebra, made it plain that she needed help. They hauled the heavy animal a short distance, amid much laughter, and then waited for Elsa to start her meal. To our astonishment, although zebra was her favourite meat, she did not eat but stood by the river, roaring in her loudest voice. We presumed that she was inviting her mate to join in the feast. This would have been good lion manners, for according to the recorded habit of prides, whilst the females do most of the killing, they then have to wait to satisfy their hunger until the lion has had his fill. The next morning, the 22nd of November, she swam across the heavily flooded river, came up to the zebra, and roared repeatedly in the direction of the rocky range, which is on our side of the river. I saw that she had a deep gash across one of her front paws, but she refused to have it dressed, and after she had eaten as much as she could, she went off towards the rocks. For several days, she divided her time between us and her lion. When George returned from a patrol, he brought Elsa a goat. Usually, she dragged her kill into his tent, presumably to avoid the trouble of having to guard it, but this time she left it lying beside the car, in a spot which could not be seen from the tent. During the night, her mate came and had a good feed. We wondered whether this was what she had intended. Next evening, we took the precaution of placing some meat at a certain distance from the camp, for we did not want to encourage him to come too close. Soon after dark, we heard him dragging it away, and in the morning Elsa joined him. We were now faced with a problem. We wanted to help Elsa, who was increasingly handicapped by her pregnancy, by providing her with regular food, but we did not wish to interfere with her relations with her mate by our continued presence in the camp. He had good reason to resent this, but did he in fact object to us? On the whole, we thought that he did not, and I think we were justified in our opinion, but during the next 6 months, though we did not see him, we often heard his characteristic 10 or 12 woofing grunts, and recognized his spoor, which proved that he remained Elsa's constant companion. Though he still kept out of our sight, he had become bolder and bolder, but an extraordinary kind of truce seemed to have been established between us. He had come to know our routine as intimately as we had come to know his habits. He shared Elsa's company with us, and we thought that in return he could fairly expect an occasional meal as compensation. In view of his attitude, we stilled our qualms of conscience and stayed on. It was now nearly mid-December, and we believed that the cubs might arrive at any moment. Elsa was so heavy that every movement seemed to require an effort. If she had been living a normal life, she would certainly have taken exercise, so I did my best to make her go for walks with me, but she kept close to the tents. We wondered what place she would choose for her delivery, and even thought that since she had always considered our tent as her safest den, the cubs might be born in it. We therefore prepared a feeding bottle and laid in some tinned milk and some glucose, and I read all the books and pamphlets I could find on animal births and possible complications. The river was now in flood, and George and I decided to walk 3 miles downstream to look at some cataracts, which are very impressive when the water is high. Elsa watched our departure from the top of the Land Rover, but made no attempt to join us. The cataracts were a magnificent sight, the foaming water cascading through the gorges, thundering across the rocks and then flooding out into deep whirlpools. On our way back, I heard Elsa's familiar hunk, hunk, and soon saw her trotting along the path as quickly as she could. I was very touched that she had made the effort, the more so that though her lion had roared desperately for her during the whole of the previous night, she made no attempt to join him. This was very gratifying, but it also reminded us of our fear that her lion might get tired of sharing her with us. It had taken us a very long time to find a mate for her. It would be unforgivable if our interference now caused him to leave her. We wanted her cubs to grow up as wild lions, and to do this, they needed their father. We decided to go away for 3 days. When we returned on the 18th of December, Elsa crept in the dark through the thorn fence which surrounded my tent, and spent the night close to my bed. This was something which she had very rarely done, and I took it as a sign that she felt that her time was near. The next day, when George and I went for a walk, Elsa followed us, but she had to sit down at intervals panting, and was plainly in great discomfort. When we saw this, we turned back and walked very slowly. Suddenly, to our astonishment, she turned off into the bush, in the direction of the big rock. She did not return during that night, but in the morning we heard her calling in a very weak voice. We thought this meant that she had had her cubs and went out to trace her spoor. These led us close to the rock, but the grass was so high that we lost track of her. The rock range is about 1 mile long, and though we searched for a long time, we could not discover where she was. We set out again in the afternoon, and eventually we spotted her through our field glasses. She was standing on the big rock, and from her silhouette we saw that she was still pregnant. We climbed up and found her lying close to a large boulder which stood at the top of a wide cleft in the rock. Near to it there was some grass, and a small tree provided shade. This place had always been one of Elsa's favourite lookouts, and we felt that it would make an ideal nursery, since inside the cleft was a rainproof and well-protected cave. We left her to take the initiative, and presently she came slowly towards us, walking very carefully and obviously in pain. She greeted us very affectionately, but I noticed that blood was trickling from her vagina, a sure sign that her labour had started. In spite of this, she went over to Makede and the Toto, who had remained behind, and rubbed her head against their legs before she sat down. When I came near her, she got up and moved to the edge of the rock, and remained there with her head turned away from us. It seemed to me that she chose this precipitous position to make sure that no one could follow her. At intervals, she came back and rubbed her head very gently against mine, and then walked determinedly back to the boulder, making it plain she wished to be left alone. We went a short distance away, and for 30 minutes watched her through our field glasses. She rolled from side to side, licked her vagina, and moaned repeatedly. Suddenly, she rose, went very carefully down the steep rock face, and disappeared into the thick bush at its base. Since there was nothing we could do to help her, we went back to camp. After dark, we heard her lion calling. There was no reply. I lay awake most of the night, thinking about her, and when towards morning it started to rain, my anxiety increased, and I could hardly bear to wait till it was light, to go out and try to discover what had happened. Very early, George and I set out. First we followed the spoor of Elsa's lion. He had been close to the camp, had dragged off the very smelly carcass of the goat, which Elsa had not touched for 3 days, and had eaten it in the bush. Then he had walked to the rock near to the place where we had seen Elsa disappear. We wondered what we should do next. We did not want our curiosity to bring any risk to the cubs, and we were aware that captive lionesses, who have been disturbed soon after giving birth to cubs, have been known to kill their young. We also thought that her lion might be very near, so we decided to stop our search. Instead, George went off and shot a large waterbuck to provide Elsa and her mate with plenty of food. I, in the meantime, climbed the big